This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Booksplode, the new Teen Titans, the Judas Contract.
I know I got a bad reputation, and it isn't just talk, talk, talk. If I could only give you everything, you know I haven't got. I couldn't have one conversation if it wasn't for the lies, lies, lies.
Hello, welcome to iFanboy Booksplode, the new Teen Titans, the Judas Contract. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and I'm here with my co-host, Josh Lanigan.
Hello, Connor Kilpatrick.
Hello, and we're here to talk about the new Teen Titans, the Judas Contract. It's technically the new edition, it's just one of the editions. It really doesn't matter.
It's an edition of the story.
Right. So there'll be spoilers for the story that came out in the early 80s, if you're worried about spoilers. And this is the show, The Booksplode, brought to you by the patrons over at patreon.com/ifanboy, who unlock The Booksplode along with the Talksplode interview show that Josh does. And we do this show every other month. We look at a collected edition. And this month we decided we'd look at one of the seminal DC stories that Josh has never read, drawn by the legendary George Perez, who is unfortunately ill and will not be with us much longer. So we thought we would take a look at one of his most famous works. I'm curious, Josh, what you knew about this story going into it.
Nothing.
Zero.
Nothing. I've actually
You'd heard of it.
Read it. No.
Never heard the term the Judas Contract.
Nope.
Interesting.
No. All I was aware of was the quote unquote famous run with Marv Wolfman and George Perez, and that it's a beloved run, that these are the same characters that are in the Teen Titans Go for the most part, and this is like the thing that defines Dick Grayson as Nightwing as opposed to Robin. That's pretty much what I knew. And I'd never read any of it. Yeah, that's about it. This brings us up to it. And Marv Wolfman has terrible sweaters. I learned that also.
This collection starts off with issue 39 of the New Teen Titans. The cover date was February 1984. And at the time, this was DC's top-selling book. So you had Wolfman and Perez doing the New Teen Titans, and you had Claremont and John Byrne doing The Uncanny X-Men, and those are the two top-selling books at each company. Very similar ideas, young people in big groups finding their way.
Yeah.
One of the downers of this collection is that you don't get the covers, because there was terrific covers, including the one that kicks off this collection, issue 39. It's one of my all-time favorite covers, featuring Dick Grayson and Wally West walking away against the stark white background and their costumes sort of sprawled out on the floor like they just took them off and what left.
I bet that I have seen those covers, but since they weren't in the book, I was not reminded of them, because that sounds familiar.
I remember my friend had this issue, and I always look at the cover in his long box, because it's just such striking, the white background and the costume. This, the thing about Perez is, amongst the many things he's good at, is that as a kid, he was one of the first people that got me to understand the costumes as clothing, and not that he draws them to look like clothes, and not, I don't think they should be drawn necessarily to look like clothes. But the idea that they are clothing. So in this first issue, we'll get to the story in a second, but I'm just giving you an example. In this first issue, both Dick Grayson and Wally West quit their identities. So Wally quits being Kid Flash, and Dick Grayson quits being Robin. And I don't think I'd ever thought about how the Robin costume worked before I read this issue as a kid. Mm-hmm. This was before I saw Burt Ward in the 66 show, you know, to really, because you can see it there, but like the idea that it was like a green sort of like unitard, and then there was a shirt over it, and then it was belted closed. As a kid, it just didn't register. Like, I thought the green was the sleeve of the shirt. Like, you know, I didn't understand that this was a whole pieces. And Perez was really good at making it seem like a superhero costume, but still you could see how it fits together. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things he was a genius at. Anyway, as we get into the story, the Judas Contract is probably the most famous Teen Titans story of all time. And it all revolves around the character of Terra, who turns out to be a spy for Deathstroke the Terminator. But what was interesting about that, and it's, I don't know if you read the essays in the beginning or not, but Terra had been introduced 2 years prior. I mean, for 2 years, she was just a member of the team. And in this issue, we find out that she's been a spy this whole time. So that must have hit like a bomb.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I thought she was relatively new, like it only showed up a couple of issues before.
Her first appearance was New Teen Titans 26. So, what is that? 13 issues.
Okay.
So she'd been on the team for 13 issues. And then it was revealed here that the whole time she'd been spying for Deathstroke, their adversary, their nemesis. And we go from there. So there's a lot going on in this collection. Like I said, the big reveal is that Terra is a spy, but it doesn't really come out to the team till the very end of the story. So the whole time we know she's a spy, but they don't know she's a spy. And so while they're going through adventures fighting against Hive and Brother Blood, in the background, the whole time you have the Deathstroke monitoring them and preparing to take them out. While we learn about Deathstroke's origin, and we meet his son, Jericho, who ends up joining the team, and also Dick Grayson finds his new identity as Nightwing. So this is a pretty big story for the time and for the fans of the team and the characters. I'm curious, I mean, this is a very early 80s Marv Wolfman. This is pre-Crisis. I'm a big fan of his work, but it's a very Bronze Age style. But how did you deal with this? What did you think reading it? What were your initial thoughts?
I did think it did not flow as smoothly and as easily as some of the contemporary Marvel stuff that we had read. I feel like I had more fun with the Captain Marvel stuff. Was that the last one we did? Yeah, Death of Captain Marvel.
Death of Captain Marvel, yeah.
And I think maybe part of that had to do with the fact that, like, I don't know these as well. Like, I just don't, like, I don't have a lot of emotional resonance with this stuff, you know, like I do the Marvel stuff. And as a result, I don't know, it felt a little clunky. It was good. Like, I got into it, but it took a while. Like, it took me a lot longer to sort of get into the flow of the thing than it has with some of the other books. It does the drama taking itself really seriously, but still being a silly superhero book that comics of this age do really well, which I like. I think it's kind of cool. I like the historical aspect of like reading a group of characters and a storyline that are like a big deal in the pantheon of comics. Like, this was a super successful, big selling comic book. And I think that's cool. You know, the art is great. I did think a lot of times I was going through it, I was like, ooh, this is not going to pass muster today in terms of its social politics.
Sure.
like a Beast Boy would be party to numerous sexual harassment. I mean, dozens just in this book alone.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, for the most part, I felt that the female characters were really pretty well-rounded and not secondary. You know what I mean? Like, you had Beast Boy objectifying, and there were other characters objectifying women all over the place, left and right. But the women who were part of the group were kind of like equals in that way.
The most powerful members of the group are Starfire and Wonder Girl.
And Terra. I mean, Terra's like huge, amazing powers.
Yeah.
You know, the other side of that, I would say, is I think it was really interesting, and this will be the spoilery part, I guess, is that the whole time you are thinking, well, I don't know how this ends. I'm not familiar with the story. And I thought, well, any normal superhero story, any comic book is going to have them redeem her at the last minute and she saves them, Darth Vader, Return of the Jedi style. And it didn't. And it was just like, nope, she was full of hate and she died. And I was like, all right, you went all the way through it. There was no redemption. There was no secondary side to her. There was no explanation. There was no abuse. She's just hated everybody and was evil and mean.
She was almost worse than Deathstroke.
Yeah. Oh no. Absolutely. She was worse than Deathstroke. Because even he was like, I was just using her for some shit. But she's wrong. I mean, like the what's the cult?
Hive.
Like yeah. They kind of weren't anything. Like right. I don't know if there's another story, but like Brother Blood and the Hive, like it was very like G.I. Joe the Animated Series, sort of like, oh, here's a cult of people in hoods. But then there's a bit. Just they're in the Hive headquarters and Jericho, which I want to come back to,
yeah,
takes over one of them, or they're listening to him, and he just talks like some New York City douchebag.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, really? That's how you're going to... And I thought that was really funny.
Yeah.
That was great.
The thug.
I don't actually know a heck of a lot about Deathstroke. I think he's a really cool character, and he shows up and stuff. But this like whole origin of Deathstroke, I thought was really interesting.
Yes.
Never read it. Again, I don't know it. The sort of explanations of where he comes from and how he came to be and his amazing manservant / best friend / Wookiee life debt partner, Wintergreen. and then further, like, I have seen Jericho in stuff.
Yeah.
Or at least referred to, and I had no idea who the fuck that was. And that was such a goddamn unique character in every way.
Yes.
Like, I was like, I didn't know what to make of him. He doesn't look like anything. He's of a time completely, but he's got this kind of interesting power, and I didn't know which way it was going to go, because Dick Grayson's like, I don't know what it is, but I trust him. And I was like, what's that going to mean? But he's just like a mute Harry Nilsson just hanging out there.
Yeah. For a young guy, he's got some serious mutton chops.
Yes, he does.
The collection itself is interesting because there's no way you can. I mean, you could. I've got the Teen Titans omnibuses, but like, this is almost like dropping you into the beginning of the third act of a story that's been going on for 2 years, right? So you don't get, if you're just coming into this cold, you don't get the 2 year buildup of this person being on the team. You're really just sort of getting the character turn here.
I don't feel like I lost a whole lot in that because we've talked about this a ton over the years. Is that in this era of comic books, you could pick it up and read it whenever, and I felt like, oh, okay, cool, here we go. That part I was fine with. I know what you mean, but you know, I can put it in context, so I sort of understand the significance. The
interesting thing about Deathstroke is, you know, when I was a kid reading these books, and in this collection, he's called the Terminator.
Yeah.
Right? He's called Deathstroke the Terminator, but mostly he's just referred to as the Terminator. You know, they call him the Terminator, the Titans. And so then in the 90s, when he had a solo book, it was called Deathstroke the Terminator. And then they just sort of... I think because of legal reasons with the Terminator movies, they just cleaved off the end, and he just became Deathstroke. So, like, his name is Deathstroke the Terminator in this book, but no one called him that. They called him the Terminator.
Yeah.
And my whole childhood, he was the Terminator.
Hmm.
It was, like, the only time I can think of where they successfully sort of changed the name of the character organically, and no one seemed to notice or be bothered by it.
Well, Deathstroke's a better name.
It is, but it's just funny because for like 10 years, he was a Terminator as a kid. Yeah.
The movies ruined it.
This whole era of comics is, you know, steeped in the shadow of Vietnam.
Yeah.
And so you get a great Vietnam-related origin for Terminator here. And it makes him interesting. The wife character's interesting, and his sons, his other son, who, Joseph is Jericho, right? And the other son is Grant.
The Ravager.
Was Ravager. He got killed. And then Joseph is his mother's son, so he turns against his father. He's good. He becomes an integral member of the team later on. This is the classic. I love the original team. This team here is sort of like the Uncanny X-Men, right? You had the original X-Men who were like, you know, the five of them. And then when Uncanny X-Men happened, a couple of the original members joined, but most of those new people, this is the same thing. So you had Robin, Wonder Girl, and Kid Flash were from the original team on this new team. Kid Flash ended up leaving. But you still have two legacy members, but then you have all these interesting new, more varied characters on the team, varying ages. You know, Nightwing and Wonder Girl are about 19 here. And I would say Cyborg and Starfire are about the same age, but, you know, Changeling, who he was called here, was younger. Terra was like 16. It's hard to tell with Raven. She has those severe cheekbones. She looked like she was 45.
Well, it's funny because I hate to say it, but like I'm much more familiar with Teen Titans Go because it was playing on a loop in the back of my house for a while. And so I don't really know. I mean, I know Dick Grayson, obviously, pretty well. But sort of the other characters, specifically Raven, is not a character I've actually read in a lot of actual comic books or even Changeling, Beast Boy, Gar, Logan. They call him a lot of things. He has a lot of names in this, and it's tough to keep track of.
He was Beast Boy when he was when he originally showed up, and they changed him to Changeling here, but whatever.
He's Beast Gar Boy. Logan. Let him be there. Yeah. You know, so I was kind of interested, and his characterization was sort of what I would have expected. Raven needs to keep that hood on because there's a severe problem with that hairline. Yeah. And it's the first time she showed up with her hood off, I was like, what the fuck is this? You know, and Starfire, I'm familiar with. I've read her in books. She's always been sort of this thing. The one thing that I was curious about was Cyborg, because when I was a kid, I never liked Cyborg. And it was because I found his outfit off-putting, and he had no personality that I could, and that was sort of the problem. Even if you watch like the Justice League movie edit, whatever, it wasn't interesting. He had no character other than poor me, but he's not poor me in this. He was just sort of blank, and there were bits where he had a little bit of personality, but again, what's funny is that if I look at Teen Titans Go, he's super fun in that show. You know, like it's a whole, like they made a decision, but here I just didn't really know where he's coming from.
It was nice to be with a cyborg who is actually a cyborg and not just the full-on robot that he is now in the DCU, where he's, you know, in this one, he's got the little tiny cyborg booty shorts, but like he's got human body parts because he's just a cyborg, not a robot.
Right.
But in the current version, ever since New 52, he's been human face, everything else robot, and it's just a different character.
Like he's got no human emotion at all. It's like less human than the Vision.
It's a good mix. They found that alchemy that the X-Men found, and that's why they're both the most popular books at the time, of character types, personality types, legacy characters plus new characters. It was a nice mix. Plus, you had, you know, Wolfman, who would go on to change the whole DC universe with the Crisis on Infinite Earths with George Perez. And then you got a guy in Perez who, you know, he's doing this monthly.
It's quite a lot.
These pages are packed, not just with detail, but panels and backgrounds. And it's just... this is a lot on a monthly basis.
I'm flipping through, and if you went to page 154 of the digital reader on your Kindle app now, it's 80% in. And basically all of the Titans have been put on this torture device, you know, that, and every sort of part of it is holding the Titans in a different way to keep them under wraps. It's a big old Kirby machine.
Yeah.
You know, it's even got Kirby dots in the middle of it. And it's just so, like, you would never see this in a comic book today. You just wouldn't and couldn't. And the other side of it is when you read this, I don't think that looks so silly. I think that looks perfect. You know, and all the little bits of, like all the regular people stuff is also really interesting. You know, all the stuff with Wintergreen is telling his story. There's all these flashbacks in this book that are, I think, the best parts of the whole thing. You know, Slade's story with his wife, and then the flashback with Wintergreen, and then, you know, it's all that just great stuff. But I think his human faces are some of my favorite in comics.
Yeah.
You know, the way that Tara looks is that she actually has a look. She has a particular face. Also, she's a 16-year-old smoking through the whole thing and trying desperately to sleep with the old man.
She has been sleeping with the old man.
Is she?
Yeah.
I thought it was just she wanted... okay, well, there you go.
Well, I assume so from this.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time we see her, she's in, like, lingerie sitting in his bedroom.
Yeah. I always feel like he was like, sure thing, and then never got around to it. But maybe that's just because I thought, well, there's no way they would do that in a comic book.
Meant for children in the 80s.
Exactly.
But yeah, no, everyone has a face.
Yes.
Tara's got sort of buck teeth because she's a young kid, and Dick has his own face, and Slade's got his own look, and everyone is immediately identifiable.
If I have any criticism of Perez's art, is that, you know me, I love comic book pirate boots. He's going to tone down the Terminator boots a little. Those are going to get in the way. The top ruff is far too long.
They're awesome. They billow.
Lean into it.
Why not? You just get a big old action story while this mystery unfolds, and then at the end, you know, Dick Grayson and Jericho help save the day, and Dick is now Nightwing, and he's got that awesome 70s Nightwing outfit. It's not the 70s anymore, but it's got the big collar with the deep V. So it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. I've read this before, but it's been a while since I've read this. I haven't read it probably in well over a decade. There's just something about the way that Wolfman writes these characters and Perez draws them that makes them really compelling. You know, you've got to find that right mix of teen angst and overlapping storylines, so many things are happening at once. Like now, you basically get one storyline, and if you're lucky, you get a subplot or a B-plot. But it isn't like the old days where the B-plot would then become the A-plot after the arc was over. It's very sort of station to station, as we say in baseball. You know, like it's story to story to story. Here, you know, here it was all about weaving. A, B, C, A ends, B becomes A, C becomes B, and then a new C plot comes in. Like it was just a constant motion that kept you reading from month to month. It's just a different way to tell stories.
But it did seem like it, you know, there was a long-term plan. It didn't feel like...
Yeah, for sure.
You know, it didn't feel like they were just flinging stuff at it each issue and hoping it would get somewhere. They were... There was a direction. There was a, you know, a long...
Well, they had to. I mean, they had to know what Tara was all about when they introduced her 2 years prior.
Sure. But, you know, they took their time with it, though.
And speaking of creepy 80s things that wouldn't fly now, so there's a little bit in here with they're planning Donna's wedding. Her character was 19 and was marrying her 29-year-old college professor who was modeled after the writer himself.
I mean... It was not terribly mature about male-female relations, even in the context of the time. You know what I mean? It was a little like, oh, this is kind of juvenile, which if you were juvenile in 1980, whatever, it totally would have been appealing. I would have thought this was great if I had read it at the time. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's how you do talk to women. That's so cool.
They like it when you constantly talk about their boobs.
It's so stark to go back and then read this stuff and be like, God, no wonder they're mad at us.
Well, the other thing is the main culprit of this is Gar.
Yeah.
And he's supposed to be immature and annoying.
Right. And also, like, he's overconfident, a loser. He's not getting any of the women. So, like, that's his sort of...
He's not meant to be charming. He's meant to be annoying and won't shut up and stop sexualizing everything. Mm-hmm. They kind of ignore him because they're probably so used to it, but it wasn't like it was Dick Grayson being like, hey, nice rack. It was...
True.
It was the annoying character. So there's, in that sense, and that was the staple of the 80s, right? Every 80s movie had the annoying character who was oversexed and...
Right, and would do the thing where he bites his fist.
I mean, I do that now. Is that weird?
I mean, it's expected. You grew up when you did.
I have a poster of Lenny and Squiggy on my wall.
It just stands out so much because you don't do that anymore.
Right.
Even if the character was a buffoon, you don't do that. And I get why. I'm not even complaining. Like, it's still objectifying.
Yep.
In a way that makes it feel like the comic book is only for dudes, which it was. You know, not by design, but that's how it was. You know, so, you know, it's like anything from 40 years ago or 30 years ago. You read it in three different ways. You know, one is, what does it say about the time that it was written? Two, like, what is valuable about this in a way that I can still appreciate, you know, and there's probably some others. But I like that. I like that, I mean, you don't want to throw out your baby with your bathwater or whatever, like, it could be both things. You know, like, there's enough here that's like, wow, this is great. You know, this is, I don't even want to say ahead of its time because, you know, they did make good things then that were good at the time and can be good now. But there's definitely things in here that are like, oh, this is comic books. Like, this is the type of comic book that you and I would have first read. This is where it would, this would have...
Oh, yeah, for sure. I read a lot of these books. I mean, I didn't... 84 was slightly too early. You know, I was reading G.I. Joe and other things like that.
Right, but these would have been around. Like, you...
Oh, for
like,
sure.
I ended up with comics because comics were around in places. So it wouldn't have been weird that I would have picked up an issue from 1984 and read it, you know, like 3, 4, 5 years later.
Oh, I definitely had...
That happened.
The New Teen Titans issues. I just didn't have
right.
this particular storyline. This was one of those storylines where it was, you know, in the years before everything was collected and or you could get things digitally, you had the back issue title. Like, it took me years to finally read the Crisis on Infinite Earths because it took me years to get the issues from comic stores.
Yeah.
And so I would hear about this really important story, the Judas Contract, you know, from friends or from, like, whatever in the issue. Like, it wasn't internet, obviously, or anything to teach you, but you'd hear about this mythical story, and it was like, how do you find these issues? How do I even know what numbers they are, you know?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever buy comics from, like, the mail order sites in the books? I think American Comics was one of them.
No, because I had so many comic stores
okay.
in walking distance in my apartment in Manhattan that I just went to those stores.
This won't surprise you as a person who loves getting stuff delivered to his house to this day. I loved mail ordering stuff. Like, it was the coolest thing. Like, it was just, it was such a cool process. And like, it was that everything was there. They would put, like, a list of books in the comic. I mean, it's a terrible ad. But at the time, there was no internet. And it would just say Thor, you know, 387 through 395.
Right.
And they would skip a couple. It'd be like 397 through. Like, well, what about those two? How come you can't get those? And, you know, you just order that, and I'd have to find somebody to write me a check, you know, and I'd give them like piles of change, you know, and they'd send them along later. And I never bought like storylines. I bought, that cover looks awesome. What's that about?
Strangely enough, I mean, again, I wasn't reading back then. I'm looking through these issues online, and they swapped from the new Teen Titans to Tales of the Teen Titans. The title changed, but the numbering didn't, just the title. That's so weird.
Can you imagine numbering not changing?
But you couldn't find these issues in back issue bins, and if you did, they were like $10. And as an 8-year-old, forget that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that's why it took me forever to get Crisis, because those like the big like issue 8 where Barry Allen dies, that took me years to save up for that issue. So that was kind of the fun of it, was excavating these stories. I'm looking at these from a technical standpoint. I loved when it would switch to the hidden camera in her eye lens, so you get like the feeling of a grainy Terminator video thing. Being shot.
Yeah,
there was just a lot of great production stuff that was probably very cool at the time. You know, black and white. And
I was hit by a couple of things. Is that one? It's really amazing to think about how kind of prolific George Perez was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, this is 80 whatever. I don't know when he sort of started doing comics, but he was steadily doing a lot of very good and very significant, quote unquote, important comics, you know, for 20 years after this, you know, and it was constant. And like you said, like,
he would still be doing it if he wasn't ill.
Oh, 100%. You know, and his layouts do not, you know, every time Terry used his powers, I was like, this is amazing. Or her powers, I mean. Just the way that he would depict that. This is a book with a lot of characters in it, and he's not skimping. Like, the characters are on every page, and they're distinct, and they're drawing their way through it. I think Perez might be the only person I can think of who is pretty good at using a left-hand panel stack. There's a bunch of times where he used up the whole left side of the page, and it worked. And I was like, all right, well, it's possible. It's not frequent that people can do it, but
it takes an all-time great to do it. Like, so he started exactly 10 years earlier. This was basically his 10th year in comics.
Jesus.
And he was 30 years old.
He has a thing where he'll put in a lot of narrow panels vertically.
Mm-hmm. Which we saw in another Booksplode in the Avengers Forever book.
Yep, and you'll see, and then also a lot of just very narrow panels is a way to get like a page with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, 10, 12 panels on a page. It's a lot. And it's one thing to be like, well, how does he get this much done? And, you know, he had anchors and colors, so he was just penciling it. I don't know how tight his pencils were. The process was different then. Then I start thinking about that. I was like, oh, shit. This was pencils. And then that piece of paper had to be sent to a person to ink it. Then that piece of paper had to go and have a colorist do it. I still don't understand how coloring worked back then. Just point that out.
It's magic.
I know they didn't color on the board. It didn't work that way.
No.
I don't know how they did it. There's color separators. It's a thing that I should learn more about because I want to know and I don't understand. And then it would come back and then they would letter on the board. Like, so all of these letters, there's four letters on this. Todd Klein is one of them. I don't think I recognize the other names. Somewhere these pages, and the pages are probably all worth thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those word balloons have been written out, cut out, and pasted on the board.
Yep.
And they came out. They were actually 22 pages. I don't know if not more, but, you know, the books were, what were these, a quarter, 50 cents when they came out?
Let's see. The first issue, well, one of these issues was, I think, 75 cents. 75 cents.
That's a lot of work going into a thing that don't cost much.
Right.
You know, and they had to sell a lot to make that happen, and that's the difference. But there's such works of art that, you know, were not appreciated in their time necessarily, at least not by a lot of people.
For sure. I'm looking at this credits page, and I recognize, some of them are really famous, but I recognize every inker's name on here.
Yeah?
Yeah, Dick Giordano, obviously. He was very... Mike DiCarlo, Romeo Tangal, one of my favorite names as a kid, and then George Perez. So those are the inkers.
So he did ink some of it.
Yeah.
So, but, I mean, the thing is, at least three of those people are fucking legends.
Yes.
Romeo Tangal, now I recognize that name from Tom versus the JLA or whatever, whichever one it was. Yeah. I can hear Tom saying that out loud, you know, but Mike DiCarlo, Dick Giordano, obviously.
And Dick Giordano, like, obviously, yeah.
Legend, both as an editor... He was in charge of DC for a while, and then also is just an amazing inker who worked on beautiful work all over the place. There's people who are just inkers. don't even have that anymore. Like, there's a couple
of Mike them. DiCarlo, he also inked Batman Death in the Family. Like, he was a name that was in a lot of DC books, especially Batman stuff, KG Beast. But he was a big DC inker. All of those inkers were huge names in the business.
Go to page 29. It's an epilogue page in the first chapter. So it's basically the epilogue of the first issue.
Yeah.
And nobody's standing around in costumes. You've got this kind of cool shot of their whatever this weird floating raft is.
They had a little raft that took them out to their island, which was rough.
Which is ridiculous.
Not even a guardrail on the raft. You couldn't be unsteady.
They don't have momentum or tides then.
It was a motorized thing, but it was just like a handrail.
I know, but as soon as it goes, you would fall over. Like, they're all standing up. You wouldn't stand like that on the subway. That's why there's handholds. No. But if you look at this page, there's no superheroes in it. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 panels. You know, you've got these beautiful cityscapes at night. The Teen Tower is tight. You know, it's framed by the moon. Everybody's wearing street clothes. He's not using costumes.
Yep.
And like the last panel is this. I mean, what he does just on the bottom of these panels on the docks is like somebody drives away. There's a couple close faces, then there's a wide shot, which is in blank space, and then there's a shot of a car driving away out an alley in a space that is so small, he should not be able to depict that. And then the last panel is Starfire sort of hanging over Dick's shoulders. He's you know, casual with his hands in his pockets, and it's just incredibly naturalistic. And all of the time, he's getting away with it by drawing a woman whose hair is ridiculous, and we don't even notice it. It's just so lived in.
The body language is just amazing. Yep. That is a pose, you know, the girlfriend puts her head on the shoulder of her boyfriend with her arms wrapped around his neck because they're both sad. And the clothes, the faces, the facial expressions, the body language, he was so far ahead of everybody else, most everybody else at the time.
There's this real combination of sensational and natural all at the same time, overdramatic and realistic. He did all those things. God, there's a shot. Page 39, just 10 pages later, there's a shot of the inside of a TV studio. And, you know, it's the middle of the page. It's maybe a third of the whole page. He drew an entire studio audience and multiple cameras and a cue card person and desks. It's insane. I can't. And then at the same time, like, you know, some of the costumes, super silly. The Brother Blood. But the whole Brother Blood thing is ridiculous.
Yeah.
He's got the dumbest costume. Everybody's treating
him. I like how they're taking him super seriously, like in the media here. It's like, this guy's got horns on his helmet. His name is Brother Blood.
What more do you need?
He has to debate the Titans on this news show.
And all the old people are like, I agree with Blood. I say we all do. It's like, you can't win for losing in this world.
One thing that Perez was very, very good at, this is all throughout his career, and I remember specifically all that shot of Starfire hanging on Dick is one shot like that. But I remember in books like in the beginning of Infinity Gauntlet was using shadow. Mm-hmm. He was very, very good at placing characters for dramatic moments in deep shadows and really playing with the light and seeing how the light would actually hit their faces. And he was very, very good at those things. He put a lot of thought and care and crazy detail into these books. And I'm sure the inkers definitely deserve a lot of credit as well.
You're right about that, and the detail is one thing, but it's really easy to look at comic book pages from this time and go, oh, look at all the detail, and that's true. But I think that if you actually, what's more impressive to me is the opposite of that, is that it exists in the same place as this sort of wonderful just character cartooning.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
So that's the thing that, like, the detail is fine.
I love his cool and it's technical, Slade face. Slade has such a great, unique face.
Yeah.
And then every once in a while, I get hit with a nice splash page action shot. Like, the beginning opens with this incredible two-page action sequence with the whole team attacking whatever hapless morons. It's just great.
He just could kind of do it all. It's like he's the synthesis of all of these people that came before him. He's got Kirby in there, and he's got Neil Adams in there, and he's got John Byrne in there. And, you know, not any one of those things. It's almost like he's not amazing at any of them, but the sum total combination of all those things is something nobody else could do.
Yeah.
Maybe John Byrne.
If you go back to it, so Byrne was doing X-Men, and he was doing this one. So you had the two top books being drawn by the two top guys at the time.
However, historically speaking, Perez is beloved. and has been all along, even before, you know, the announcement that he's, you know, in late stage cancer, and he's, it's very strange. I can't think of another time where like he's not going to live,
right?
You know, but he's still alive and people are, you know, talking about him. It's like as if he's already died, but he hasn't, because he's sort of on this like,
yeah, it's hard.
Like a farewell tour. Not really, but it's very strange, you know, but he's so beloved. Like nobody ever had a bad thing to say about him.
Well, you know, I've met him a couple times at conventions and like as a mm-hmm. younger kid, not in our later life, but
yeah,
he came across as someone who genuinely loved every yes. minute of it.
Yeah, really happy. Yeah, that's I think of him as really happy.
And he had his bad, I'm sure he had his bad days where he sure. was like, I can't draw this fucking page one more time. But, you know, when you're someone like us, we've met a lot of people who make the comics. We've interviewed a lot of the people who make the comics. We've had drinks with a lot of people who make the comics. Some of them are just like annoyed. You know, it's yes. almost like they just don't want to be a comic creator. You never got that feeling from Perez. In fact, he yeah. just wanted to do more and more and bigger and bolder.
And he did. He kept doing comics. I mean, yeah. like, he still showed up. John Byrne, maybe his legacy hasn't aged so well.
I mean, his art is still speaks for itself. He just sabotages
I know that. I'm saying when you talk about, when you want to yeah. talk about, like the total package of a, like, I can really like this and I can respect the man a lot.
Yeah.
It's a double whammy. Let's just take it away. There's not a John Byrne page out there that doesn't have something beautiful in it. Don't get me. That's not true. There's not a John Byrne page before the year 1997 that doesn't have something beautiful in it. Even then. I'm always thinking of there was the Spider-Man chapter one.
The Spider-Man
which came
book,
out
yeah.
when we were in college.
Soured you.
Yep. But I was so looking forward to it.
I know. And we all were.
It was just terrible. But I do wonder if I were to go back and read that now. Write this down. You know, like, how would you feel about it? Because at the time, you know, what were we into? I remember being one of the first books that when I came back to comics, I was really disappointed by. Because what I saw was Spider-Man Origin and John Byrne. This is going to be great. But I'm coming at it with a 20-year-old sensibility of wanting comics to be serious and whatever. Maybe if I read it now, I'd be like, no, this is fucking brilliant. And I just couldn't appreciate it then. I don't know.
All I know is when I was in high school, Perez and Byrne were my two top guys. Like, everyone else... I read the X-Men, but my friends were all super into X-Men, so for them it was all about Jim Lee. And I liked Jim Lee then and now, but I had my notebook in high school had a little sleeve, so I put the promotional Infinity Gauntlet image in it. Like, I was a Byrne Perez guy growing up.
Yeah.
And my friends were, you know, Jim Lee, Rob Liefeld guys. That's just so this is always the art that's appealed to me.
And one of those is age better than the other.
We didn't go in really granular detail in the story, but it's a fun adventure romp in the best possible overwrought 80s way.
Like the perfect melodrama appropriate for the time.
And you were totally right. The ending is not what you would expect it to be.
No.
And gives it more power in that way.
Yeah, and I think it's really, you know, every story has a cliched ending that you go with, and most do that, and most comics can get away with doing that, and here they did the opposite, which tells me that they're making choices and thinking about what they mean and, like, what we want to do with it as opposed to just being rote, and that's, there's a lot to be said about that.
And the whole time, you know, the characters, the Cyborg and especially Changeling, they're like, no, she's good inside, we can find the good in her. Nope.
Yeah, and you're just expecting, okay, they're going to Luke Vader this shit. Nope.
And you know what? She hasn't really ever really come back.
I was wondering about that.
She came back in one of those, I think it was, you know, all the dead characters came back. Was it Brightest Day, Blackest Night?
I don't remember.
But for the most part, like, they've had flashback stuff, but she's never been, like, resurrected in a real way. Obviously, it all changed in the New 52, but I'm talking about the old continuity.
The Jericho costume makes no sense.
No, it's terrible. But it's terrible in a great...
in the great way. But it's just like, why are you... Your dad is like the Terminator, and everybody... You see what everybody else looks like?
Because he's more like the Star Child. You know, his Ravager's costume was exactly Terminator's costume. Same costume.
He's got a whole Ren Faire thing going on. It's just from out of nowhere.
He's a hippie, man. He's got the chops. He's got the flowy... flowy
hippie town.
Puffy shirt and a scarf.
The Deathstroke costume is great.
It's one of the all-time great costumes.
Yeah, it is. There's a bit here near the end where Nightwing and Jericho are infiltrating, and Nightwing has like a hood. And I was wondering, was that like part of his costume? It was like a hood with goggles. Was that a thing that was supposed to be part of his costume at this early
interesting
early phase? Because I was like, I'd never seen that.
Yeah, you're right, because it's sort of attached to his thing. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I don't think I ever saw that again on him.
Good.
And he pulls a full-on, like, technology-fused gas mask out of somewhere. He's not, he's not, he's never a utility belt.
He's no pouches. There's people who have pouches.
He has Tara little has pockets sort of in pouches. His wristbands, but those hold like smoke bombs. But that wouldn't hold his full-on gas mask.
That came hood has to be built into the collar.
Oh, the structure in that hood. I mean, just from watching enough Project Runway, I mean, that thing to hold up, he's got to have like metal rods in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great costume. I mean, it's totally of the age, and he would look silly in it now. But as a thing to move on to from Robin and at the time, like it's great. Like it was easy to accept for some reason. I mean,
we've talked on the show several times about this Dick Grayson Clark Kent relationship.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
it's there from the beginning. Nightwing is a Kryptonian character from myth,
which James Robinson brought back in when he was writing, I want to say, Action Comics.
Right, but that's here from the beginning. Something he got from Clark. And so his whole identity as an adult is from his friendship with Clark Kent. I always like that bit.
Yeah, I do too.
So, ratings on...
Ratings.
The new Teen Titans, the Judas Contract, the new edition.
For people who think that ratings are reductive and sometimes not terribly useful, you're not wrong. But here we are, we're going to do it, but you're not wrong, you know? I do want to point out is the end is that they don't tell anyone that Tara was evil.
Right. Because her brother is also a hero, Geo-Force.
I know, but that was also a really interesting choice.
Yeah.
Which leaves open all these other sort of possibilities or whatever. It's crazy. I did not expect that choice.
I'm going to go 4.4.
I was just going to go a solid 4.
4.45.
Yeah.
It's very good. There's a lot going on here. There's a lot of story. Not all of it's great, but there is really great stuff in here.
My take is that I wouldn't consider it a must read. I wouldn't be like, if you want to know comics history, you have to read this. But I do think you have to read something a lot like this with these people. You have to read some George Perez. You might as well read this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have to be this, but it's a fine choice.
Although I think if you want to understand, I mean, again, this book pretty much represents DC in the 80s. This was the most popular book going. It's not a bad choice. So there you go. The new Teen Titans, the Judas Contract, new edition. We enjoyed it. It was fun. And George Perez is a legend. And everyone should go out and read something that he did because there's always something really fantastic in what he did.
Yep, absolutely.
But that's the Books Explode Show. Every week, Josh and I have our Pick of the Week show, which we talk about the new releases of the week. We also have Josh's Talk Explode Show, which is the sister show to this show. We alternate months on that with this one. Those shows are all unlocked by the patrons at patreon.com/ifanboy. And we'll be back in 2 months with another Books Explode. I'm not sure what it's going to be yet, but we have a whole list here, including Spider-Man, whatever the book was called.
Chapter 1?
I think that is what it was called. Until then, we'll be back next time. I am Connor.
I'm Josh. I don't think I bring myself to pay for that. It's still too raw. Don't try to be an inspiration. Just wasting your time, time, time. You know about the best I'll ever be. See it in your eyes. I know I got a bad. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.